How to be a .NET architect with Colin Pear.
The Azure DevOps Podcast is a show for developers and DevOps professionals shipping software using Microsoft technologies. Each show brings you hard-hitting interviews with industry experts, innovating better methods, and sharing success stories. Listen on to learn how to increase quality, ship quickly, and operate well. And now your host, Jeffrey Palermo.
Welcome to the show. I'm Jeffrey Palermo, your host. Make sure to check out www.azuredevops.show for past episodes and show notes. And I'm excited to speak virtually at a lot of user groups as you're doing online meetings. It's a lot of fun. If you run a .NET user group, love to get on your schedule. And if you're tuning in for the first time, the Azure DevOps podcast is for developers shipping software with Microsoft technologies. And my goal for all of you developers and development teams is to be able to move fast, deliver quality, and run your systems with confidence. That's why I do this show. And if you have some specific issues you'd like help with, well, that's what we do here at Clear Measure as a software architecture company. And stay tuned for a new video podcast called Architect Tips as we dive into topics using some short, 5-10 minute video clips. I'm excited for our guest today, none other than Colin Pear. He is the director of engineering at Skimmer. You can find it at getskimmer.com. He's also an in-service bus champion, which is an award that a particular software gives, open source contributor and Clear Measure alumnus. And he's running a .NET software engineering department. So Colin, welcome to the show. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great. How's it going?
It's good. It's good. Not very often we get a Clear Measure alumnus and former architect on the show here at Clear Measure, and you're running your own department now. I want to kind of dig into that and share, hey, what it's like, moving into architecture and more and higher and higher leadership positions. But for all the developers listening, can you introduce yourself and what's your development journey been?
Sure. So that's where we should start off, is kind of, how did I get to where I am today? And, what was kind of that road looking like? It started out when I was at home, learning how to do HTML all by myself on the computer. I remember the internet just came to town. It had been out in other places, but we're a small town out in the country. So internet came, it was awesome. And then it was like, wow, they've got all these web pages. I got to learn how to do that. And so I started out self-taught. And then I kept going on. And I was right at about the time of the dot-com boom when all of that stuff was happening. So anybody who knew how to do any HTML or anything web-related, they were scooping those people up. So I quickly, it was amazing because, I'm 20 years old. I got a job interview for a company in the Silicon Valley. They actually flew me up there to interview for a whole day. And it was just amazing. So that's where I got my real first job. And that was diving into .NET. And then it's been .NET ever since. So just kind of growing, expanding that way. And just mostly being self-taught. I kind of got a pass on the schooling part because I was just feet first right into it. And that's kind of how I got started. I did go to school afterwards. It took me about 8 years to get an associate's degree because I'd take about one class.
You're working so hard.
Yeah, working so hard. Well, my companies were paying for it, right? We'll pay you to go to school. Okay. So one semester, one class per semester, spread over 8 years. So that's kind of me in a nutshell. I ended up in Texas. And not long after that, I ended up getting a job at Clear Measure. And then that's sort of where everything started for me. And I started as a senior software engineer at Clear Measure.
Well, then jumpstart and fast forward, because there's probably a lot of people who are saying, oh, okay, I'm a developer now. What do I need to do to move into an architect role or leading teams?
Right. For me, it was a little bit of a natural progression. It's a different mindset when you start to go from engineer to some of these team leads and, up higher, where, my last job title at Clear Measure was chief architect. So I really went up the whole ladder there. And that's a shout out to Clear Measure, because that made my career explode. So just being at Clear Measure was a big part of me moving forward. Lots of learning opportunities and the such. So it's a big mental shift when you go from the guy doing stuff to the guy, or person, I should say, leading stuff. The big thing was learning to let go of doing so much of the doing things, you know, because we're all engineers, we're all software coding, and we all want to do stuff because that's why we code. That's, we love this, right?
It's fun.
It's fun, absolutely. And who wants to, you know, that's why we do it. So you have to sort of let go of that to some degree when you start to lead teams, because there's other responsibilities you have to take over. And so that's kind of the big mental shift. Our software engineering manager at Clear Measure, Steve, he would tell us, okay, there's things below the line, and that would kind of represent things you do tactically. And then there's above the line, and that's where you have to start doing strategical thinking and planning and, you know, making sure things are happening that are supposed to happen. So more of that management type of things going on there.
Mm-hmm. You know, at big companies, there are a gazillion job titles for people who are in the mix designing and rolling out custom software. But can you simplify it? Some people that are just starting their career, maybe their title is junior developer, they don't even know what the ladder is, because, you know, it's not like it's published out there in clarity, because the industry is just not organized like that. But what are the general rungs that a developer should look for?
It's a great question. So, you know, the basic, you know, the general scale is something like this. There's a junior level in software developer, engineer, whatever you want to call it, because there's terms that are used that are, and I think they're kind of overloaded. Sometimes it's software engineer, sometimes it's developer, and they mean different things at different places. And I think that goes across the board for all titles. But essentially, you've got this kind of a hierarchy, which is a junior level software engineer, senior software engineer, and then something above that is going to be a principal. We at Clear Measure, we'd call them a principal engineer, at that point, you're kind of a team lead. And so that makes you a little bit more responsible for the team, but you're still doing coding. Above that, we start to get into what we would call the architect level. And so that's essentially the hierarchy from the tactical side of things. And when you get to that architect level, that's when you start to switch away from the tactical, and like I said before, and start to get more above that line, doing more of that strategical thinking. After that, you know, it's there's a whole gambit of titles after that, director of engineering, et cetera. And for me,
management,
that's right. So if you really want to simplify it from there, there's, you can think of it from the other direction, which I've kind of learned this recently. The way we're looked at, you know, from top down is there's a development team, and then there's a manager of that team. And then there could be managers of managers if you have multiple teams. And so that becomes sort of the hierarchy. And what you call a manager, if it's a director of engineering, if it's an engineering manager, if it's a CTO or a, you know, whatever it is, that's kind of the hierarchy how an engineering shop kind of looks. So that's across the board at most of the companies that I've seen.
And when you were slinging code all day, every day, did you ever think, man, I want to code for the rest of my life. I never want to stop coding.
Absolutely. That's essentially what you're thinking as you're doing code. You love it. It's great. It's amazing. And then there's a shift at some point. I don't know if it's just you're getting older, you're getting more mature. Maybe there's too many things to keep up on. I don't know. But essentially, there's a natural progression or shift usually for people. And that's not for everybody across the board. Some people are fine, you know, just doing the engineering, excuse me, just coding, just writing software. But then, you know, eventually you sort of shift and go, hey, I want to do some more. want to get more involved. And that's when you start to get into the strategical. And that's awesome. You know, the thinking and figuring out and strategizing and, you know, getting a team to work on something and in a way that you're kind of designing and making it happen. That's what's really neat, you know. And for me, you know, when I had to make that shift was my first big client. I don't know, could we say client names on here or?
If you have permission.
Okay. Well, let me just say this. When I was at Clear Measure, there was a client we had in New York City, and it was amazing. I got to be that was my first gig as an architect. And so, you know, that was for me, a super exciting, you know, I'm going to New York for the first time. I'm hanging out in the big city. We're in downtown Manhattan, you know, all those things. This client was a really tough client to have as a first client, because that's a whole, you know, you're getting to a world and all of a sudden it's 100 miles an hour. You're just going, it's fast, it's aggressive, especially for, you know, New York City, I think probably has, you know, they're kind of that mentality at a lot of places there. It's just hard, fast moving. We want stuff done. And so it was a whole, you know, shock for me. It was a culture shock. I had lots of, questioning. I was questioning myself constantly going, holy moly, can I do this? What have I got myself into? Oh my goodness. I used to just do things and that was so easy and straightforward. Now I'm working with clients and customers and trying to figure out plans for getting what they want done. And it was just a crazy shock for me. But that was like being thrown right, you know, feet first into the fire. And I think that tempered me moving forward, as I did learn a lot from that.
Mm-hmm. One thing that comes to my mind is when I was working on mastering development, I could say, you know, I was building stuff for myself, maybe akin to building a treehouse or building a shed or building a deck. And then as I went in it, it's, well, I built some bigger stuff. Maybe I even built a house for myself and I did everything. But there's some point where you look at, if you want to build more things, there's no way that you can do it by yourself. And so if you're going to build a bigger house or a commercial building, you know, all the way up to a building, a skyscraper, to do bigger projects, there's no way to do it yourself. And so that you have to find some way to organize the work of the whole team to get bigger things done.
That is correct. And that's that essentially sums up, you know, what you're trying to do when you start to get into those higher levels of, you know, working with a team, being an architect or a manager or whatever it is. And that's, again, you have to, this was one of the key things for me was, there's a concept which many people are familiar with, which is this idea of imposter syndrome, where you constantly question yourself, you know, should I really be here with these people? Can I justify, you know, myself and what I know, my skill set? I feel, you always feel, not always everybody, but a lot of people feel like scared, you know, it's like, hey, I'm with these, they're going to find out I'm a fraud. I don't know all the things. There's too much to know. And so that's one of the, again, you got to get past that. You're not going to build a house anymore. You know, back in the old days of the internet, you could be a full stack developer, you know, as JavaScript, HTML, and maybe some kind of backend ASP, you know, classic ASP or whatever it was, PHP. And that's all you needed to know. And you could be a full stack guy or girl, but that's not how it is now. There's front-end technologies. there's a plethora of them. There's all kinds of things in the back end, different data sources. We've got cloud. We've got Azure. We've got all kinds of things. And there's just way too much to know. And so you have to let go of this concept of, I have to know everything. Mm-hmm. And I stopped doing that. I really started relying on the people on my team who I knew were experts in these different various areas. And I focused more on organizing them and making sure they were seeing the picture I was trying to paint. And as soon as I did that and I stopped being afraid of not knowing everything, that made the world of difference. And you know, again, you need to be technically savvy to some point, you know, to run a software team. So you do need to know some of the things, right? However, you don't need to know how to do all of the things. And at some point, you got to let somebody else figure out what type of load balancer you should use in Azure and just focus on, hey, I need to have a load balance site. And that becomes more of the bigger picture that you need to focus on.
Yeah, makes sense. Now when you're working on larger projects or maybe multiple different projects or maybe multiple different customers in the consulting world, how do you possibly time slice your focus and stay effective when you're not actually, when you don't know every line of code in every code base?
That falls back to, again, you got to really rely on your team and know your team. You got to be intimate with your team and know where their strengths and weaknesses are. And you need to be very intimate with that because you really have to let go at that point. I can't, you know, if I'm on 3 or 4 projects, I can't be intimate with the code base. I can't be intimate with every detail of, you know, all the things going on. Instead, I have to know what needs to be done and I have to get the right people focused on it and making sure the team is moving forward on that. So that's a big, big thing you have to deal with when you've got multiple, you know, clients like that or multiple projects that you're working on. The inverse of that is kind of like, okay, you know, at Skimmer, where I'm at now, you know, Skimmer's sort of it's a business to business kind of, you know, application. You know, we provide people that run pool businesses software so they can run and manage their, you know, their business. And it's all pool related. So that's kind of the niche market there. It's not a super complicated domain. So we have a smaller team. So we don't have multiple teams, et cetera. You know, at this point we have one team and I'm the director of engineering at that team. And so I'm in charge of top to bottom, everything that's in the company that's engineering related. So that's what I'm in charge of. So there's a lot of hats I have to put on, including getting my hands dirty and writing code, because it is a smaller team. We still have to deliver stuff. But at the same time, strategizing, helping the company decide, you know, how to roadmap things. What are the best features to work on? What can we get done within the time we have, et cetera? And so that's kind of the inverse, you know, of what we talked about a little bit earlier.
Speaking of that in coding, some developers probably think, oh, architects don't code. Therefore, architects don't know what they're talking about. But you just threw out another open source project. So you're still slinging code. Talk about that dichotomy and the whole fable of the non-coding architect.
Oh, man. Okay, that's a big... That's a big question to answer because I've got a lot I could throw out there, especially about what I had worked on. Just we'll get to that. But like I said, if you want to be in charge of a engineering team, you have to be technically savvy to some point, right? So you have to know and understand what's going on. So you don't ever truly give up coding. You're either going to be involved at your work projects. Code reviewing, you know, again, organizing and making sure the team is working to achieve what the business needs or wants. And so, but doing it from a technical standpoint. So that being said, you still have to get in and, you know, either look at code reviews and be a part of it that way and check out some things as you're going. The other thing you can do is work in your own time, which is what you'll have to do a lot as well, writing your own code and working on your own things. So at Skimmer, there's a lot of things I would like to do or figure out. So I'll take that time and go, okay, let me figure out technically if I can make a little MVP of something and see if it works. So I will work on things and build my own stuff on the side. And one example of this is a NuGet package I created called a Blazor Component Bus. If you're not familiar, Microsoft has this new awesome, you know, sort of a SPA front end. Their version of a SPA front end kind of an application called Blazor. Blazor is very component based, so you're building web pages with components. Should all sound familiar to all you front end people out there. One of the things that I was interested in was from an architectural standpoint. I like to build distributed systems. Really big distributed systems guy. You know, I took the advanced distributed systems design course from Particular Software. It's given by Udi Dehan. They're the makers of NServiceBus for .NET, and it's basically a framework for doing distributed systems. It's the underlying framework, pipes and wires to allow you to do messaging, et cetera. And they're a big, Udi's a big fan, or he's very big on doing service-oriented architecture. And so that's another term that's just kind of, what does that even mean? But essentially, you know, you're breaking up your system into different services, if we can call them that. And you can think of it as bounded contexts around certain things. So you have all these different bounded contexts, and how do they talk to each other? And that gets you into distributed systems. And I'm going on a the long route here. But what's important is that, you know, what's in those bounded contexts, they don't have dependencies on each other, but they talk to each other by shooting messages out, events. Hey, this just happened. This just happened. This just happened. And the other services or bounded contexts can then decide if they want to do something based on that message coming through. So you have to bring that concept all the way down to the UI as well. So when you get to the UI, if you think in terms of like Amazon web page, you're selling books or any kind of book page, you know, somebody where you're selling products, whatever, there's different pieces of data all over that screen. And a lot of that data is going to be owned by these different bounded contexts. So how do you continue that idea of we have separations of things, data included? How do I get all that together and bring it into one spot to kind of display? So you can take that concept now with this package, this NuGet package that I created, and it lets you do messaging between the components on the page. So it's like, oh man, it's kind of a, it's a different way to think about software. And so once you start thinking about software in terms of components and messaging and these things, being able to talk to each other, but without compromising their boundaries, you get into this whole world of awesomeness. And that's what Blazor Component Bus is about. It's about making a way for the components on the web page, giving them the ability to communicate without crossing those boundaries.
Many thanks to our podcast sponsor, Clear Measure. Clear Measure is a software architecture company that empowers clients' development teams to be self-sufficient, moving fast, delivering quality, and running their systems with confidence. Whether starting a new project or developing new technologies or techniques, Clear Measure sets up your team to deliver world-class results. Learn more at www.clearmeasure.com. Clear Measure, empowering software delivery.
Yeah, there's a, I wouldn't call it a pandemic, but there's a problem, pervasive problem with UI frameworks, and that they're object oriented under the covers, but the programming model that is apparent is more structured programming or procedural code. And it's too easy to have a parent and a child relationship and just use a regular .NET event or maybe a callback, a direct callback to maybe communicate from the child back to the parent. But you can't decompose a screen very far with that pattern. You have a big old jumbled mess. So I look at this kind of thing and it's actually making the UI truly object oriented, and the information to pass to different parts of the screen as an object, as opposed to a method call that's directly referenced.
Yes. I guess I didn't really think of it in those terms, but 100%, yes, that's exactly it. So you've summed it up in a nutshell there. I could have said that, and it would have been a lot quicker. But I like to tell stories.
Yeah, totally. So, okay, so this is an open source project, and people can actually use it, right?
Absolutely. You can go and it's out there. You can just pull it down and add it to your Blazor project and, you know, start running. There's some examples out there to show you how to do that.
What's it called again?
It's called Blazor Component Bus. So right. you can look that up and search it and pull it right in and get going with that. And
Awesome. Okay. So with so many things, so many technologies coming and going, if I take you back, look back 10 years or some significant period of time, are there any technologies that you thought, oh, I need to hurry up and invest in this because this is going to be useful, and then it turned out to just be a passing fad?
Yes.
There's been... So tell us what stands out in your mind, and then how do developers know, how can you equip them to watch out for those things so that they invest in the right things and pass up the wrong ones?
Yes. So let's bring it back to a little bit about, you know, running the team, the architect, right? So this is when you're architecting that application, part of that is choosing the right tech stack, tools, NuGet packages. Hopefully you're using Blazor Component Bus. If you are, you're off to a good start. but you have to make those decisions, right? And that's where sometimes, again, I've heard engineers, you know, they go and say, well, what is the architect really doing? You know, they're not in here writing code. What's going on? And it's that translation of business value into something technical. And so you're trying to deliver business value. And that's another concept that I think is extremely valuable, especially if you're moving up the ladder, is learning what is business value. And what does that mean? What does it come from? Because somewhere, all of those features and user stories that you're working on, they came from someplace. And so that's the invisible boundary that you have to look beyond that border and go, wow, where is this stuff coming from? And as soon as you start thinking like that, uh-oh, you're going to be starting to move up the chain and becoming this type of an architect or whatever. So now to kind of bring that back and get to my point, again, sorry, I like to take the long road.
No, that's good.
When you're on these projects, you have to be real careful, you know, especially, doesn't matter if you're on a, what you're doing, services company, or if you're working for your, you have one project or one, you know, excuse me, application you're working on for your company, whatever it is, you have to never lose sight of business value. And what that basically translates into is we can't compromise business value to use the latest and greatest cool thing just because we want to. And so that's a lesson that's really hard learned, because as engineers, we want to, yeah, I want to do Docker, I want to do, you know, Blazor, I want to do all of these great, cool things. And I have ran into, you know, leading teams where I've let those decisions be made kind of on the fly instead of doing it myself. I instead let other people decide that. And as soon as I did, I regretted it, because those people, for example, somebody said, hey, we need to use React on this project. Super important. We got to do it. Everybody's doing it. And it's like, okay, we're all excited. Let's do it. And that one person who knew React ended up leaving. And then it's like, we're left holding the bill at the end of the day. And we're, you know, we had to scramble to get everybody up to speed as best we could. We had very, you could almost say we were juniors, junior React engineers with one guy who knew what he was doing, and then he left. So that's something that all of a sudden you're crunched for time. You don't know what's going on. You've got a technology that you shouldn't have used. And so you got to be really careful. And my advice moving forward on things like that is to keep it simple. If you have a need, an actual need that, you know, helps to meet the business value for using Docker, per se, if using Docker makes sense because it's going to help us achieve that business value, that's when you start looking at these things and using them. You don't use things just because you want to, no matter how tempting it is. You've got to focus on the business value and making sure that you are staying on that path and not diverting, because you'll get lost in the woods and it's mm-hmm. no fun.
Well, I look back and I remember, I guess, 12 years ago, maybe, where there were, I heard people saying, oh, you better get on the Rails train. You better get, if you're not doing Rails, you know, you're going to be irrelevant. Rails is taking over the development world. And now who's using Rails?
Exactly. Right. Exactly. So who's using that? So there's times when you might actually make those decisions, right? we're looking at where we are. We, you know, we can sort of see into the future a little bit. And, you know, let's say you decided to use Rails on your project. You still, what you need to do at that point is make sure you keep things decoupled. That's one of our basic, you know, object-oriented programming, you know, concepts is, you know, keeping things segregated, you know, decoupled, loosely coupled. And so if we keep our front end or whatever technology we're using, you know, loosely coupled to our back end, that gives us the opportunity to lift and shift out things that have become obsolete. So if you're using a technology that's no longer around or isn't very viable, maybe it's the Ruby on Rails, we can then take that out as long as we haven't tightly coupled it to the rest of our system. And that goes back to, oh, this is why I love messaging so much, is because that makes messaging is the ultimate decoupler of software. And I love using in-service bus to do that in so many levels, especially with the big balls of mud, as we all know them to be. It becomes real simple to add features capability by just adding in messaging. Let the ball of mud send out messages, and then you can all of a sudden hook on lots of new features and things, and then start to break the ball of mud apart.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of that, and another fad that may be waning out, microservices. What have been your observations on microservices, and what is that kernel of good idea that developers need to be latching onto without accidentally riding the fad train?
Right. So I'm not really a big fan of microservices. Okay, don't shoot me. Don't shoot me now. I'll explain why. The concept of microservices is sort of goes down that path of thinking, let's do some things distributed in a distributed mindset. The problem that tends to be with microservices is they are still highly coupled in the fact that you're using request response. Most of the time where I've seen microservices implemented, it's always using a request response model. And when you do that, when you send a request out and you're waiting for it to give you a response back, that's coupling. That's a type of coupling. There's a couple of types out there that you can have in a system, but that makes it coupled. And then when you start breaking things out into microservices, all of a sudden they're, you know, you've got a distributed ball of mud instead of just a ball of mud, which was much easier to deal with. But when you distribute a ball of mud, that becomes extremely painful. So the kernel in there is that, hey, going distributed is good, but you have to do it in a way that keeps you decoupled. And that's where you do things like messaging. And so messaging comes in and highly decouples those things. Because again, you can fire off events and then let things respond to them if they so choose to. And then that way you're not waiting for some response to come back.
And when you say an event, you mean a little file with something in it in a ordered asynchronous queue.
Yes, right. Exactly. So messages, so there's two types of messages. You've got your commands and events is what they call them. And an event, or it's a message. That's essentially, those are the two types of messages. And you can fire off a message and it will be dropped into a queue. And these different, you know, whatever you want to call them, services or microservices or whatever you want to call them, can then look at the queue and say, okay, what's in there? I see this message came through. I don't care. And it can ignore it, or it can look at it and go, oh, this new event happened. Excellent. I'm going to now do some work over here. So again, that brings you back to that decoupling. So,
Yeah, I'm thinking for all the developers out there who are still learning all the overloaded terms in our industry, and we have the .NET events and this and the that.
Yes, I should have mentioned that up front a little bit. So,
awesome. Well, as we close up here, for the folks that are just really working on mastering their development and coding skills, looking forward to taking on more leadership roles in the future, what advice do you have for them for things they can do now that would kind of set them on that track?
My advice would be to start spreading out a little bit and learn about new things. You know, we all want to learn, and that's what we like doing. So start learning about things. Learn what Azure can provide you. Or, you know, learn what the new frameworks can provide you, what Blazor can do for you. Learn about microservices. And you don't necessarily need to go into the depth of I'm a technical master on this subject, but being aware of them and the value they can provide is essential as you're moving forward and starting to think strategically about how to achieve business value for your existing employer or, you know, your clients or so be it. And again, just to repeat that one more time, business value. Start thinking about things that the business deems valuable. And that's as simple as a definition as it is. Whatever the business thinks is valuable is business value. It doesn't necessarily mean money coming in. Well, of course, that's important. But if the business says, I need a report because that report's going to save me 4 hours a day, you know, that's valuable to them. And so they're willing to spend that money. So think in terms of that. And that's going to get you strategically thinking, oh, how can I do that report? Oh, cool. Now I can start thinking about all these technologies and things I've touched a little bit. Oh, microservices would be great here. Or Blazor Component Bus would be the great NuGet package to pull down to help. You know, you start to put together the pieces. And again, at the core of it is achieving business value.
Awesome. Well, Colin, I appreciate the words of wisdom that you shared with the listeners today. And thanks for coming on the show.
Hey, my pleasure.
Awesome. And until next time, keep shipping.
You've been listening to the Azure DevOps Podcast, a show for developers and DevOps professionals shipping software using Microsoft technologies. Go to www.azuredevops.show for show notes and other episodes. On behalf of your host, Jeffrey Palermo, and our sponsors, thanks for listening, and may God bless you.